Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Happy New Year and welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes. Each week on this program, I have the privilege of visiting with veterans of World War II. The idea behind the program is to honor their service and sacrifice for the sake of the freedom that we enjoy in this new year, 2010. A lot of years have passed since what the men and women you hear on this show do. We also want to preserve their stories for the future so we can look back and understand just what kind of price was paid for that freedom we enjoy. And thirdly, hopefully along the way, as we listen to some of these stories of the men and women who've been called the greatest generation, maybe we can be inspired to leave a legacy for future generations of Americans. My guest today is Floyd Hixon. He's 91 years old, and I see him a couple times a week because he lives at the same retirement facility where I visit my grandmother a couple times a week. That's the Wyndham in Fresno. Not here to advertise for him, but it's a great place, and people like Floyd make it even better. He's got some stories. Maybe he was your teacher at Fresno State once upon a time. If you had anything to do with poultry, he would have been. He also, as we wind this story through the next hour, will share some incidents where he had some run-ins with Hank Iba, the legendary basketball coach. Run-ins might not be the best word, but he had a connection to him and has some stories to share there. And he has many stories from his time in the 136th Infantry Regiment of the 33rd Infantry Division in the Pacific Theater of World War II. Well, Floyd, let's start early on. I guess it all starts in Holdenville, Oklahoma.
That's where both T. Boone Pickens and I were born.
And your lives have been parallel paths ever since.
No, not quite, but we happened to be born in the same town.
And I understand he even inscribed a copy of his book for you.
That's right.
And you'll be rooting for the Cowboys against Ole Miss.
Oh, yes.
So you grew up in Oklahoma, and I imagine you were a student at Oklahoma State when yes. Pearl Harbor happened. Is that right?
Let's see. Yes. I was in graduate school, but I just barely started.
All right. Well, before we get to that memory of December 7th, tell me about Hank Iba. And for those who aren't familiar, Henry Iba, one of the legendary basketball coaches in college basketball history, coached the Oklahoma State Cowboys, had tremendous success there. And you actually took a class from him at Oklahoma State.
Yes, I made a C in it even. And the marvelous thing about Hank Iba, he had the best memory of anyone that I've ever met in my life.
And he demonstrated that for you.
Yes, he did. I hadn't seen him for well over a year, and I was in Stillwater going from Officers Canada School, reporting to the 33rd Division in Washington. Hank came in the store where I was buying a raincoat, and I said, "Coach, how's your basketball team going to be?" He looked down at me and said, "Pretty good, Floyd."
And your eyes got as big as saucers, huh?
I nearly fell flat at his feet.
And I guess that wasn't the end of it. You saw him again later, too?
4 years later, I saw him again at Kansas State when he came up with the football team. And then the following March, I'm going down the hall in Kansas City where K-State was playing in the basketball tournament. And Hank saw me coming. He said, "Hello, Floyd."
And you think about all, not just the players he coached, but the students he had. And he could remember every face, apparently.
Well, reporters and people.
Either that or you must have caused him a lot of trouble in that class where you got a C.
I was sitting next to one of his big basketball guards, about 6'2", and so on. I don't think I would have bothered him.
Well, and we're going to get to the story of how you ended up at Fresno State for decades and decades. I know now you're a Cowboy fan. You're also a big Bulldog fan, and you're looking forward to the baseball season coming up as well as basketball going now. But back then, 1941, December rolls around, December 7th. I like to ask every guest on this program what he remembers about that Sunday, December 7th, 1941. Where were you when you heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor?
Well, I was lying on the floor listening to the radio at a family from church had invited the wife. We had just been married in October and listened to the radio, and they broke in to tell about the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And, of course, I was quite interested because my brother was there on the Phoenix.
Mm-hmm. And you knew he was there.
I didn't know he was there at that time. But you knew
he was in the Navy, and they're talking about the Navy getting hit hard.
Yes.
How long was it till you found out that your brother was there and that he was okay?
I don't really recall how long before I found out, but I did see him one time during the war. I happened to be in Honolulu going to an Army motor school, and he was over at Pearl Harbor, and I went over and talked to him a few minutes, the only time I saw him during the war.
I bet that meant a lot to you, though.
Oh, yes.
I've heard a lot of stories. I mean, there's some families that had multiple brothers, but even my grandfather, he had a brother, and he got to pull him out of the line once in Europe once. I know it meant the most to him. So that's a neat little connection there. Well, let's tell our listeners, Floyd, how you ended up in the service. Were you drafted?
I was drafted.
And you're a newly married guy.
I'm newly married.
So you probably knew that draft was coming.
Well, I wasn't surprised. Uh-huh. I was doing some lab work, so I took my samples over. My brother-in-law came in and told me, and he was being drafted one day apart from me, but I changed so I could go with him. I thought he could show me the ropes. He'd trained with the 45th Division in Louisiana for a year. Mm-hmm. Well, it turned out that after we got to Fort Sill together, that the next Monday, we got there on Friday, Monday, I'm on a bus, and I waved goodbye to him and saw him once after that during the war.
The best laid plans, huh? So much for him showing you the ropes. Well, what did the Army decide to do with young Floyd Hixon?
Well, they sent me down to Camp Barkley, Texas, and I finally worked my way up to corporal, and then I did a no-no. I went to see my wife without a pass,
ooh,
and I became Private Hixon again.
Funny how that corporal disappears in a hurry.
So,
was it worth it?
Well, yeah, it was. My wife. But anyway, I transferred to the whole platoon was transferred to another company, and they had an inspection, and the inspectors came out from San Antonio, and for some reason, our men, they were good fellas, but they were scared to death of the inspector, who was only a first lieutenant. He sat down on the gun trails and tried to make us as comfortable as possible, and I could see the officers getting pretty unhappy over on the sideline, so I started volunteering answers. Lo and behold, a couple weeks later, I get shipped off to OCS.
They saw an officer in the making, someone who has the guts to answer questions and gets the answers right.
Yeah, I was trying to save our necks.
So here you had gotten a corporal, back down to private, and now they want to make an officer out of you.
Yeah.
Well, that must have been exciting for you.
Oh, yes.
Any of your buddies jealous over that?
No, I don't think so. We had another fellow in the company who was sent to OCS.
So you went to OCS, and then I imagine it probably wasn't a whole lot longer that you got shipped out overseas.
No, from there I went to, there were two places the farthest away that I could go, either Fort Dix, I think it was, and Fort Lewis. Mm-hmm. Sure enough, they sent me to Fort Lewis. I didn't know who was there or anything else. And so I went through Stillwater and picked up the wife, and that's when I saw Hank Iva.
Mm-hmm. And he remembered you.
Then went on to Fort Lewis. And then they shipped us to the desert, 40 miles west of Needles, and we were training to fight Rommel in North Africa in the desert. And so suddenly once they got Rommel on the run. When they got Rommel on the run, they changed plans, shipped us to Hawaii, and had us train as jungle fighters.
Mm-hmm. And what's going through your mind this time? Are you kind of eager to get somewhere where there's some action, or are you kind of liking the fact that it's taken a while to develop?
I wasn't really eager. I didn't volunteer to run up to where the fighting was. It would come soon enough, I figured.
It did come eventually, and amazingly enough, you survived it all. You're here talking to us today, and we're very thankful for that. Floyd has the Bronze Star, which we'll get to a little bit later on and have him explain exactly how that came about. So you go through all that desert training and don't get to put it to use at all. When you say they're training you to be jungle fighters, what kind of things did they teach you that you hadn't figured out in the plains of Oklahoma?
It was mainly the fact that you get into the kind of jungle growth and so on down the line. For instance, in New Guinea, I didn't have to fight in any of it, but this kunai grass was quite a deal. Mm-hmm. That stuff was high, and it's hot to be out in it and so on. And then, of course, it was wet. If you want to read some people that really gave everything they had, read about the 32nd Division. They were there at the same time we were, and I was in the hospital. I wasn't wounded. I had yellow jaundice, but I was in the hospital with the captain of the recon troop in 32nd Division. And so we were comparing notes, and I knew some other fellows that were in that division, and they really sacrificed.
Well, and that's one of the really neat things to me is to hear one veteran talk about what other veterans or other units went through and be able to look at everything you went through and say, you know what, somebody had it worse than I did. Somebody went through even more.
Some of the fellas had to sleep standing up in water waist deep.
That does not sound pleasant to me. There are so many horrible things that people went through in World War II, but Floyd Hixon is here to talk about his experiences in the war. We're at that point where we need to take our first commercial break. When we come back, we'll hear how Floyd ended up in New Guinea and other places in the Pacific, the kind of duties that he drew, the close calls he had, and what he's been up to since then. Floyd Hixon, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest this week is Floyd Hixon. He's 91 years old, but you never know it if you saw him running around and running circles around people like me. He's got plenty of energy, and maybe that's how he made it through all the time he spent in the U.S. Army in World War II with the 136th Infantry Regiment of the 33rd Infantry Division. Their first overseas deployment came in New Guinea, but the way I hear it, Floyd, you didn't see a whole lot of action yet
Guinea? Some of the division did, but I didn't see any.
And you weren't complaining about that?
No, I wasn't complaining.
Now, what was your rank and what were your duties?
I was a lieutenant, second lieutenant, until we got to the Philippines, and then we got promoted. But mainly it's training, just training, and as infantrymen, even though I was a mine platoon leader. That is, we handled laying mines and booby traps and picking them up.
Which is a pretty dangerous job.
Yes, one of my former sergeants went to Europe, and he got his leg blown off in a minefield, but he did get some, brought him some good things. He went and came back home and married his nurse, and was the postmaster in Six Lakes, Michigan after the war.
How about that? Well, that worked out just fine for him, marrying his nurse. I've heard I interviewed a gentleman in Kingsburg, had the same kind of story about that. So you had to go out and remove mines? Were you actually doing any of that over there?
Well, the enemy really didn't lay a lot of mines in the Pacific. The Germans were very skilled. Quite a deal there. And so I'm happy that I was in the Pacific rather than Germany.
Sure.
And so we didn't really have any problem with mines there, and it's just training.
And when you're training these infantrymen, what kinds of things are you trying to impart to them?
Well, for instance, we set up a little course, and the riflemen would run through and shoot at these targets that came up, and we'd set a booby trap somewhere along the line, and they'd just trip wire across the trail with a quarter stick of dynamite on it so they'd know they hit something, and then they'd shoot at these targets as they came up. I had one that didn't go off one day, and I was pulling on the wire to see what happened, and it went off.
Uh-oh.
Happily, I'd taken the dynamite off. All I had left on it was the blasting cap.
Or you might not be sitting here talking to me right now. Well, how often did they ever avoid tripping those trip wires, or did you fool them every time?
Oh yes. They were up in the Philippines then, why you began to have these booby traps and so on down the line. But mostly, unfortunately, I had more men hurt on my side than I did on the enemy side. And for instance, I can give one instance that got to me. I had these booby traps set out in this little town, and a little boy came walking up to one of my sergeants. He said, "How did you get here?" He said, "I came across through there. I went out and took all the booby traps up. I thought we could get along without them there." The kid missed them, I'll never know.
Wow. I bet that must have just taken your breath away. Well, you talk about training all these infantrymen, and it strikes me what a thankless and incredibly dangerous job being an infantryman in World War II was, no matter where you were, really. Yeah. What was the morale like? What was kind of the mindset of these young men that you're training?
I believe the morale in World War II was good, generally speaking, all over. One thing that I point to many times, you don't have any humor in Vietnam, Korea, or these other wars like we did. There's no Bill Malden. There's no Sad Sack. But we had Bill Malden and Sad Sack.
So you read those books and those scripts pretty heavily, huh?
Yes. For instance, when I moved to the Wyndham, the fellow across the hall was the subject of one of Bill Malden's cartoons.
Oh, yeah?
He died of a heart attack.
Well, you guys had lots to talk about then with Bill Malden. I know the museum downtown here in Fresno has some of the original copies of some of Bill Malden's work, which is just tremendous. And if you've never checked that out, I'm sure Floyd would highly encourage you to do so. So you're training soldiers in the Philippines, and eventually the action gets a little closer than it had to that point. When did you realize, you know what, things are heating up a little bit?
Well, the thing about it, I went up to the front one day, and the first thing I realized after I'd been in the Army for a while, when you look at the history books and you see the blue line and the red line, and the blue line is the good guys and the red line is the bad, forget it. Those lines cross each other so many places you wouldn't believe till you actually get out there and realize how it is. For instance, I went up the road with the Army engineers to see where they were going to put a bridge. Well, I thought when we left that machine gun behind us, I thought, we are in enemy territory. Well, and I found out our infantry platoon had been up the road 2 miles that morning already and didn't find anything. So anyway, they looked the situation over. Then the next day when we went up, they were putting a bridge in at that particular spot.
But then you never know when a few stragglers might come back around from the other side.
Oh, yes, they did. They did.
Now, every veteran that I've ever interviewed on this show has at least one close call or a moment that he looked at and said, you know what, that could have been it for me. Had I not made this choice instead of that choice, or if this bullet or this shell had hit there instead of here, I wouldn't be sitting here. My kids would never be here. My grandkids would never be here. Now, with you, I understand at least one of those moments. If there are more than one, I want you to share them all. But one of those has to do with an invitation to go with one of your higher-ranking officers that you turned down? Do I have that straight? You would have been standing around drinking coffee with them when the shell came
in? It was, the fellow who had this platoon and battalion headquarters got killed. So they picked me out to take his place. So about noon, the adjutant for the 2nd Battalion headquarters came by and stopped at my pillbox, and I said, I'll be up there about noon. He said, okay, and drove off. So the captain of what would be my former company, came by and said, well, come on back, take a bath, and get your stuff together. So, fine. It wasn't any fun up there in those pillboxes on that road. So I went back with him, and he got to playing cribbage. And he played, and he played. And I'm beginning to walk the floor. I wanted to be sure and get up there before dark, because you didn't wander around after dark. You got shot, and then they looked to see what they shot. And so anyway.
Right, friend or foe, they were going to shoot you. You might get shot by your own guy because they can't see
you. We had an enlisted man that did that. He went out one night, and when he came back, the guy shot him. He didn't kill him, but he shot him.
Oh, man.
But anyway, when I got up there that afternoon, I found out the fella I told I'd be up there at noon. About noon, he and two other officers and an enlisted man were standing drinking coffee. The three officers were the only people I knew in that outfit, and came a Japanese shell and killed all four.
So had you not been with the guy playing cribbage, had you been up there on time, you would have been killed. When you figure that out, what does that feel like in your brain? Does it kind of really hit you hard, or you just kind of shake it off and say, oh, that's war?
Well, I'm glad I wasn't there.
Amen. That makes two of us. When you think back, and I know we've got a lot more ground to cover here because you're in the war through the end of the war and after the war and had some interesting experiences after the surrender was signed. When you think back on the most tense moments or the ones that made you feel the most uneasy, or the most frightened, if you will, What were those moments for you? What was the toughest thing that you had to do?
Well, the toughest one that I ran into is after a little shootout during the night, we went up this river looking for a couple of more enemy soldiers. And, well, we went for a ways, and they were probably long gone, so went back up to the main road, and lo and behold, I looked down, and here's one of my enlisted men and some Filipino guerrillas coming up the river, and they were close enough you could yell at them and get their attention. I told them to go up and come up to the road, give up on it. And so I turned away, and as I turned away, there's a shot fired. And I run back and look over, and there's all kinds of shooting going on. Well, I can't see. I can see they're taking cover, and they're shooting at something. So one of my enlisted men and I, we climbed down, and it's steep. It was steep enough, if you fell, you'd fall all the way to the river. And we're coming across there. Suddenly all the shooting stops. Well, when the shooting stops, here comes my enlisted man out from behind the rock. And he looks up and sees me. He is the best shot I had in my platoon. He sat down and took a bead on me.
So he was ready to take you out if you were somebody else.
Yeah, he was going to do it. And you can't shoot your own man. I had a green handkerchief. That wouldn't have done to wave that. And happily, he heard my other man yelling and recognized his voice. But wow. The thing that really saved us was the fact that Filipino guerrillas were busy going over this guy's corpse for souvenirs, because they would have shot all the ammunition they had and then looked to see what they shot at.
And you had plenty of experience with that, and we can tell just by listening to you there. It's that time where we need to take another quick break, but when we come back, I'm going to put it to Floyd and make him tell us about this Bronze Star he has, because you don't get a Bronze Star for nothing, whether you claim to or not, and we're going to get the scoop on that when we come back. Floyd Hixon, 91 years old, our guest today. We'll be right back. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Time to continue with Hometown Heroes and our visit today with Floyd Hixon of Fresno. He's 91 years old, retired for a couple decades now from Fresno State, where he made his reputation as a poultry expert. And it just occurred to me, Floyd, I wondered what kind of poultry you saw in the Philippines, or was it more monkeys and lizards?
Fighting cocks.
Yeah?
On Sunday morning in Maui and Hawaii, you'd see all these Filipinos carrying a rooster under their arm going in one direction.
Uh-huh.
Wasn't hard to figure out.
And a lot of money exchanged hands, I'm sure. Well, you could have told them what to do with those chickens in a lot of different ways, I'm sure. And over the years at Fresno State, I know a lot of people took your classes. Maybe some of them are listening today and probably thinking about their own Floyd Hixon stories. But we're getting his stories about his time in World War II with the 33rd Infantry Division, more specifically the 136th Infantry Regiment. And Floyd, I've seen a little shadow box with a medal in it, and it looks to me like the Bronze Star. So I want an explanation here. I think our listeners would like that too. How did you come to be the recipient of the Bronze Star Medal, which is a pretty prestigious decoration?
Well, actually, mine, I feel a little guilty about it sometimes, but as it was worth 5 points for coming home, and I had a wife at home and a little daughter that I'd never seen, I'm not turning it down.
Well, but I think you'd be crazy to turn it down.
But essentially what it was, that our captain went to Manila on a leave, and he saw all these other officers down there with all these decorations, and he came home and wrote up all of his platoon leaders for the Bronze Star for retaining their platoon as a rifle platoon. Mine was a mine lane platoon.
So yours was a mine lane platoon, but you had to retrain them for rifles. Well, if you hadn't done that, they wouldn't have been prepared for their work, right?
Well, actually, they'd go through basic training.
Sure.
And basic training was the same for all of them as far as that goes.
Right. Well, I think that sounds worthwhile to me. It certainly refocused them and had them in the right state of mind, although I guess the one guy you probably wish you hadn't trained that well, because as we heard before the break, he almost shot you. He had just won a shooting contest the day before. That's not the guy you want taking aim for you when he doesn't know who you are. But you survived that. You're here talking to us today. I'm curious, as these battles are raging on, and you're on different islands in the Pacific, and you end up in the Philippines on Luzon, right?
Yes.
And are you getting a sense of what's happening in the big picture and where the war is going and how soon it is to an end?
We made a practice landing the day the war ended, the shooting stopped anyway. And so within 2 months, we were to make the initial landing in Japan. But instead, the war was over, and so we went in peacefully.
Now, I want to talk to you about that and about what your role was going to be. But is there anything else from where we left off and with you getting the Bronze Star and all that to when the war ended? Any other experiences that you had that stand out in your mind?
Well, it always stood out in my mind while we were guarding this radar station out on this little island. Here's about 200 men guarding a radar station. Maybe they had 100 there. And on each side of us are thousands of Japanese. You can see the islands they're on without field glasses.
That's how closely together these islands are.
Yeah. But their planes would fly over our radar outfit on the way to bomb Morotai. And so then our radar people would pick them up and warn Morotai they're on the way. And they'd load their anti-aircraft gun, turn on their searchlights, and wait for them. But the thing about it, I was young and naive at that time, not having been in any real combat. And so I asked these radar guys, I said, did any Japanese planes ever fly over here? And he said, yes, the day we landed, 4 Japanese Betty bombers flew over treetop height. Well, now remember, I have not been in combat yet. I said, did you shoot at them? Hell no. And I learned after that was wise advice.
You don't want them to target you. Well, and I understand you guys had to kind of interrupt some activities when that would happen. When they'd fly over, sometimes your poker games would get interrupted.
Pinochle,
uh-huh. So what would you guys do?
Hold our hands till the air raid was over. They never bombed us. They were bombing Morotai.
So the island next to you is getting bombed. You guys are playing pinochle, but the lights go out.
Yeah.
And you don't try to pull one out of your sleeve or slip one from your pocket. Just hold the hands in your hand, huh? The cards in your hand?
No. We did manage an enemy water buffalo approach our perimeter one night and got annihilated.
An enemy water buffalo, not to be confused with a friendly water buffalo. Well, did it make for good eating, or was it too bullet-ridden?
Oh, I doubt it. I don't know what happened to it.
Would have been awfully tough. Not like a good fresh chicken.
No.
He is a poultry expert that we're talking to today. Floyd Hickson is our guest. He's 91 years old, but you can tell, I'm sure, in his voice, the youthful enthusiasm that he carries with him every day. And everybody who knows him over at the Wyndham in Fresno, where I see him quite frequently, will vouch for that. And I've heard some of these stories. I know there are more stories than we have time to tell in this hour-long program. But I'm curious, you mentioned what was happening at the end of the war, but as the end of the war drew nearer, did you start to get a sense that you were getting closer to going home? Did you start to kind of pine away for being home? And how often did you hear from your wife? Did you get any kind of letters from her?
Yes. For instance, while I was in the desert, I mailed my laundry home to her. And she'd mail it back. And lo and behold, when we shipped out for Hawaii, I was not going to tell anybody we were leaving. So my laundry had just left to go home. And 30 days later, it came back to me in Hawaii. It finally caught up with me. I'd already bought more clothes.
They had more than you knew what to do with. Well, I've heard a lot of stories from veterans, too, where they were waiting and waiting and waiting for letters, and then they'd get 50 or 75 at the same time. That ever happened to you?
No, we never. Ours was pretty good about that.
You mentioned you had a daughter that you'd never met.
Yes.
Did you at least get a photograph or anything?
Yeah, I got some photographs and so on. She was about 3 years old when I got home.
You know, every time I hear a story like that, and every once in a while a veteran will share that, I have 2 little girls, 5 and 3. You've seen them, you know them, and I can't imagine not seeing a child till they're 3 years old. How hard was that for you to know that you had this little girl that she saw your picture on the nightstand, but you didn't know each other?
Well, my wife showed her my picture all the time. Uh-huh. And when I got home, she says, "There's your daddy." And she came right over and hugged me.
Wow. Must have been a good picture of you. Well, you mentioned, and had this happened, I don't think you would have been coming home, and I think you'll agree. You mentioned that you were set to invade Japan, that you guys, your unit, was going to make the initial landing. I've seen estimates.
There were other units,
sure,
too, but
right.
Two or three divisions were going in abreast.
Well, and I've seen the official military documents that estimated 1 million American soldiers would have been killed in the invasion of mainland Japan. Seems to me that when you heard about the bombs that were dropped, that must have been a big relief to you.
Yes, it was. One thing that surprised me, I read recently, that apparently it was known that there were some American prisoners of war in Hiroshima, and so they sacrificed them.
That, you know, and it the decision that Harry Truman had to make, only just a short time after he found out they even had these weapons, because he didn't know before Roosevelt died.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone envies that position that he had.
No, I admire him for his decision. I would have hated to have made it. But I had a friend who was in another division, and they liberated the prisoners from Bilibid Prison in Manila.
Uh-huh.
And he said they looked like they just crawled out of a sewer.
Yeah.
And he thought the atomic bomb was a great thing.
Absolutely, and I've interviewed some of those POWs who were liberated toward the end of the war, and they're absolutely thankful for that, because they might have died in captivity or, you know, without some heroic efforts. We had someone from the Cabanatuan raid just a couple weeks ago, and there's so many incredible stories out there. And getting on with your story, you're itching to come home. You got this little girl at home, but the war ends, and you don't have enough points yet? You had to stay on occupation duty a little while?
Remember, I got that Bronze Star. That was 5 points.
Uh-huh.
No, the war ended, and I came home in December just in time for Christmas. I got home about December the 20th.
Wow, that must have been one special Christmas.
Yes, it was.
You mentioned your daughter running over and hugging you when you got home. What was that like for you? What was going through your mind when you got closer to home and you started to realize, boy, this day that I wasn't sure for a lot of nights was going to come, and here it is?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It just worked out naturally. It seemed like it's as if I'd just been down the street and didn't come home.
You usually don't run into that much resistance walking down the street.
No.
That you ran into in the Pacific. Well, and I'm going to try to pull a few more of these stories out of Floyd Hixon before our hour's done. We'll take our final commercial break here. When we come back, we'll talk about some other highlights of his time in the service during World War II, maybe a little bit of what he's done since then, and how he stays so young at 91. It's Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We come down the home stretch now with Floyd Hixon, our first edition of 2010. Can you believe it's 2010, Floyd? Did you ever think you were going to see 2010 in 1945?
No, I didn't.
I thought that's what you were going to say. You know, we just talked about how you would have been in the first wave of troops invading mainland Japan in late 1945, had the bombs not been dropped and the surrender signed. But what I didn't ask you when we talked about that before our break there was what your duties were going to be. And I think this is important. I think our listeners will be awfully interested in that. You weren't necessarily looking forward to this duty. Tell us what that was.
Well, it was destroying Japanese equipment, war material like bombs, shells.
Well, that's what you ended up doing.
Yeah.
But I'm saying if you had invaded mainland Japan, what was your duty going to be?
Well, I was a graves registration officer. I was to pick up the isolated burials and account for them.
What a morbid job that is.
It wouldn't be fun.
Well, and you didn't think it was going to last very long.
I figured my dog tags would be among those they were bringing in.
And I think there's probably a good likelihood that that would have been the case. We're both thankful that that didn't happen. And how many kids and grandkids and great-grandkids wouldn't be around?
Well, 14 grandkids and about 10 or 11 great-grandkids.
That sounds like enough to me. course, your daughter had already been born. You'd finally see her. You talked about that when you finally got home. But you did stay in Japan. You guys didn't invade, but you were the occupation forces, and yes, you were there for about 4 more months after the war came to an end. So that's when you had the duty you started to tell us about. What were you doing, and how dangerous was that?
Well, what would happen is we'd get these Japanese laborers. The government ordered them. They show up. You're not responsible for keeping track of them or anything. But I'd pick up about 100 laborers, two or three enlisted men, and we'd go out and destroy war material. For instance, we had two explosive instances. One of them, they sent out a bunch of Bangalore torpedoes. These are water pipes with explosive in them, and you stick them under barbed wire, for instance, and set them off, and they cut the barbed wire. And they also, of course, would cut you if they went off. Well, I got a big load of them out, put them in a hole, set off a charge. Did they explode? No, they didn't explode. Scattered them all over the place. Well, I was afraid of the things. I didn't want to ask my enlisted men or the laborers to touch them, so I picked them all up and carefully put them back in the hole. Took a little while. And then out came a truckload of rubber clothing to protect horses against chemical warfare, capes and so on. So I unloaded the load on top of the pile and set the pile on fire and went home. It went off.
Was anyone around?
Set the woods on fire. No one of my co-workers heard the noise and went up there and saw us and put it out.
We didn't know you were arsonist Floyd Hickson.
Well, I didn't think about it doing that.
That must have smelled real nice, too.
And the same thing, I had another problem. I had knee mortar shells. They were little small shells, about 2 inches long. So I filled this hole with them and set off a charge, and they just scattered them all over. They did not have fuses in them. The Bangalore torpedoes had fuses. I was really afraid to handle them myself, and I didn't want to ask anybody else to do it. So anyway, I piled the mortar shells with no fuses back in the hole and put a bunch of parachute flares on top of them and started the parachute flares burning. Well, when the parachute flares got to the mortar shells, they exploded this time, set the woods on fire again.
There were some woods left to catch on fire?
Yeah, they were all around there. I only had a little space, about 100 yards wide and 200 yards long.
Was anybody ever hurt in this?
No, nobody got hurt.
Thank the Lord.
I rushed down to the streetcar station and trying to get called for help. The guy didn't speak English, and I didn't speak Japanese, and everybody hung up on him. Finally, I decided there wasn't much smoke coming up there, so I thought I'd go back up and see what happened. And so I went back up, and I had an Indian boy from Michigan named Halfaday, and he had never been in combat, but he had joined us in Japan. And so I said, "What happened?" He says, "Oh, I sent them up there, and they put the fire out." He said they didn't want to go. I busted one of them across the seat of the pants with a shovel, and they went up and put it out. I would have hung the Congressional Medal of Honor around his neck if I'd had one.
Yeah, I certainly got you off the hook there. I'll tell you, the more stories you tell me, the more I'm amazed that you're sitting here talking with me today at age 91. You faced a few odds and dodged a few bullets and fires along the way.
Oh, yeah. Then we had another incident that they sent up some chemical warfare neutralizer, and I didn't know what to do with that hardly, and I wanted to burn it. That was all I could think of, but I wasn't sure you could do it safely.
Sure.
So I got a can of it and gathered all the Japanese laborers around me and had them read the label. And then I made a motion of throwing it in a fire we had going. And they said, "No, no, no, no." Well, I was pretty sure you could do it, but I finally had an acid test. One of the workers was sitting on the ground in front of me doing something. I knew he had read the label. So I tapped him on the shoulder, and he turned around and looked at me, and I threw the can in the fire and watched him. If he had run, I'd have run. But he turned back to work, so I burned him.
I don't know if I ever would have thought of that. Those are some pretty ingenious things, but that's what you're left with. I mean, you don't have an instruction manual to take care of this and that.
All I had is the inventory.
And you had to get rid of it.
Yeah.
Well, and I think it's pretty common sense why you had to get rid of it. You didn't want someone else using it against you or using it against anybody else.
No.
So how long did that take you to get rid of all this stuff?
Well, I don't know that it was all gone by the time I got through. We did have one bomb that I had a little problem with. It was 1,000 kilos, which would be about 2,000 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, they had taken it up there and stuck it in this little hole in the side of the hill and then turned it crossways. Well, it's a 3-foot door, so my men had to work half a day getting that stupid thing out of there. And we'd already tried to blow up one about 10 kilos or something by running over and jumping in a rifle pit a little way, and it didn't go off. But we blew up an anti-tank mine a few days later at about 6 pounds from the same spot, and I thought it was going to cave the rifle pit in. I am so glad that bigger one that we tried to blow up didn't go off. But the big one then, we just put it on a truck, and they dumped it in the ocean. I wasn't doing it. I knew I didn't want any part of that one.
You know, mothers always tell their sons don't play with matches, but they never said anything about trying to destroy munitions from a war. But that's what I'm picturing in my head. I mean, it's just disaster waiting to happen on all these. Did you ever get rid of that bomb?
Yeah, I put it on a truck. They hauled it out and dumped it in the ocean.
And it's probably still sitting there. Wow. And you know, you don't think of those things when you think about war, but that's a reality of every war, that there is stuff like that left over and sitting around. The question that came to my mind, was there ever anything, obviously something that big you can't take home with you, but were there ever any things that you thought, you know what, this would be a nice souvenir to bring back?
Well, I brought home a saber.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of mine who was a pilot, he had been shot down in the Pacific in World War II, and he admired it greatly, and I gave it to him, and somebody burglarized his place and took it.
Oh, that's awful. That's awful.
If I had kept it, I would have tried to find the family. You could identify the owners of those sabers.
Exactly.
And I know a family that did just this. They found the family in Japan and gave them back the sword, diary that had belonged to their
that's
son.
That's so neat. And a lot of them had the Rising Sun flags that would be signed by members of the hometown. I've heard some stories like that, too, where they got back in touch. You know, another thing that I think our listeners would be interested in, you talked about your brother being at Pearl Harbor, then you were in the service not long after. Obviously, you both came home from the war. But your father had been in World War I, and I'm curious if that gave you any perspective on the mindset you should have going to war.
No.
Didn't make a difference whatsoever.
No.
But you still have your father's medal, victory medal from World War I.
Yes.
That's pretty neat. I think a lot of people would like to have that kind of history preserved in their own lives. Well, Floyd, we got about 2 minutes left in the program. I know we could spend an hour talking about your 3 decades at Fresno State and the poultry department there, and not to mention all the coaches that you ran around with during that time. We talked about Hank Iba earlier. Pete Biden is just as much a legend in college baseball as Iba is in basketball. But as far as World War II is concerned, and you've spoken to high school students about this, is there one message that you try to get across about why you did what you did and the people of your generation did what they did?
Well, we did, shall I say, what we had to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we complained greatly. I mean, there's no normal soldier that didn't complain.
Sure.
But we did it. We got back. And we managed to laugh sometimes, not always. And sometimes we remember when our hair turned slightly gray, but we did it.
And I get a sense humor is still a big part of your life today. You laugh a few times every day, don't you?
I try to.
I can tell, because that smile is always there on the face of Floyd Hixon. Well, Floyd, thank you so much for spending this time with us today. Thank you for serving our country. And for the impact that you've had here on the Valley since moving here more than a half century ago. You're going to stick around for a while, right?
Well, maybe at 91, sticking around is a relative term.
Well, you look great for 91, my friend, and keep it up. That's Floyd Hixon, our guest today. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes. Thanks for listening today right here on News Talk 580 KMJ.